Scott Spears back here with you on this Tuesday, March the 3rd, 2020. 3-3-2020. 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and we have got a great guest for this 45-minute duration. She is one of my favorite actresses of all time. I know she is one of yours as well. She has graced the stage for many, many years. The big screen and the small screen. You probably remember her best as Jackie and Roseanne's mother on the hit TV series Roseanne and the Conners, Bev Harris, or maybe for picking up an Academy Award in the movie Bonnie and Clyde. She's a very unique lady, a very unique actress, and it's always a pleasure to welcome her to these microphones. And she was on the Today Show in the beginning. How about that? Which has been a few years ago. What a pleasure it is to welcome Estelle Parsons. Estelle, how are you?
Thank you. I'm wonderful. How are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Now, Estelle,
where are you? In Lorain, Ohio.
We're in Marion, Ohio, just outside Columbus.
Marion, Ohio.
Yep. President.
Close. Lorain, Marion.
Same type of.
Close.
Yeah. President Harding was born in this city.
Was he?
He was.
Wow.
Yeah. Now you,
and there's a lot of auto racing out there, I think, too, isn't there?
There is. There is. Now, how are things in New York today, Estelle?
Well, it's early here. I don't know how things are, but they look pretty good. We're having all this beautiful weather. It's going to be 60 here today. And then it, you know, hovers around 40 or so. We haven't had a winter, which kind of disappointed me. I like a good snowstorm now and then, being from New England. But we haven't really had a winter, and already it looks like it's turning to spring.
It looks that way. What's Estelle, living in New York, what's a typical day like for you these days?
Well, I'm in a musical of Michael Friedman's called Unknown Soldier at Playwrights Horizon. And we're in previews, so a day for me looks like going to my trainer. And then getting up about 8 o'clock, and then going to my trainer for an hour, and then hanging around, and then going to rehearsal for the show from 2:30 to 4:30, and then having dinner in a diner, which I've practically had everything on the menu, and it's a big menu. And then going to do the show at night. Playwrights Horizon is on 42nd Street, and... it's a beautiful show. I'm only in the beginning and the end, and there's a beautiful 11 o'clock number. Somebody in the show calls it the Princess Track, where you just show up and then you appear at the end, so that's what I do. Michael Friedman is, he wrote Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which was a big hit and set a lot of people on a good track in the theater of success. And he died of AIDS shortly after we did a tryout of this musical up at the Williamstown Theater Festival. That was 4 or 5 years ago. And so some people who worked with him on it up there, Trip Coleman and Danny Goldstein, have continued on with it, and so we're doing it now.
Mm. You know, Estelle, at this point in your career, to get up and perform, is it still a kick for you to get up there and do your work?
Oh, it's not a kick. It's a really hard job and really hard work. This musical is very abstract, and it's been very hard to really figure out the... Because it's abstract, it's been hard to figure out the tone of it. So it's taken me like 5 or 6 weeks to really get on my... get in my groove to really, you know, have a consistently wonderful performance. So I was thinking the other day, it's interesting how it doesn't matter how old I am, I can only speak for myself, it doesn't matter how many, hundreds of shows I have under my belt and movies and TV and everything, every job is just the same. You're a nervous wreck in the beginning. What is it going to be? How are you going to be able to do it? And then finally you do it. Now, that only applies to me, maybe, because I try to always find a big challenge. If I'm going to bother to work, I'm always looking for a challenge, something I haven't done, something that, you know, will really be an exciting time. So I'm always going through the whole thing. I think I'm no good. I think I'm not an actress. I think, what am I doing here? I think, oh, I better quit. I better get out of this. One day I said to the director, get somebody else to do this part. I just can't do it. And he kept saying, I'm not worried. I'm not worried. I'm not worried. Oh, I'm still here, and we're going to officially open next Monday. So finally I found a performance that seems to work for me and the audience, but it's a long haul.
It's interesting. When a part comes to you, what do you look for exactly that would make you want to do it at this point?
Well, first of all, I look for something I haven't done before. Like I just did in the fall, Tony Kushner, who is probably one of our very best American playwrights at the moment, did a play at the Public called A Bright Room Called Day. And there's a part in it that's of a female ghost who's sort of the role of women through wars, through the ages. And it's, every once in a while in the play, there's a page of poetry that this woman comes in and, not recites. You're a character in a play. You can't recite poetry. You've got to make it alive for your character. So it was a terrific challenge. I worked on it for a couple of months at the Actors Studio. I also thought it would require an enormous amount of energy, and I wasn't sure that I'd be up to it because I had this strange, horrible thing happen to my back last season. I had to give up some of the most wonderful jobs I've ever been offered because there was something wrong with my lower back, which nobody wants to have that happen, do they? But there I was for 6 months until a wonderful guy operated on me, and I became whole again. But it's a long recovery. I thought, can I do this job, and what will I do with the poetry? So I worked on it a couple months at the Actors Studio, and then I worked on it all summer and recited it to anyone who'd listen, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, but it was something I'd never done before, just kind of abstract poetry like that, but with meaning. And I had the most wonderful experience with the audience. It totally spoiled me because I had this, because of the part, this ghost, you know, who really belonged nowhere but in the ether or something. I could just tell from the audience response whether it was reaching them or not, you know? Mm. I don't know why, it sounds crazy, but I could just tell, and I was able to work it till I finally got this wonderful response that I wanted for the audience. And of course, as you probably know from the past, I love things that directly contact the audience, like Miss Margarita's Way, which was one of my very best pieces to do, a classical piece of dramatic literature, but which was done directly to the audience. I'm always in that strange thing, not stand-up, which, you know, is just not that interesting to me because you have to get laughs, but where I want to engage directly all those wonderful live human beings who are there in that wonderful group energy. So I had a lot of fun with that show, and now this was a whole other thing. Singing at my age, most people don't do, and all of a sudden I burst into song in this musical. So that was a bit of a challenge. And my voice teacher of like 20 years ago came. And She didn't come to see me. She just happened to be coming, and I just happened to be trying to visit her again. And she said, you don't need any voice lessons. You sound wonderful. I just sit back and enjoy it. Well, it's really exciting to have vocal cords that work well when you're 92. You must admit that.
Absolutely. Now, do you like to sing?
Oh, yeah, I love it. Singing was my life. I started out as a singer. I sang in every choir I could find when I was a kid. I loved singing so much. And then when I went to college, I had a double octet, and I sang and played the piano, and I sang and played in the piano in bars and stuff. And then I did several musicals. I started out that way. I did all of Brecht and Weill stuff, Mahogany and Threepenny Opera and Man is Man. I've just had a wonderful time singing. And then I fell into acting. Well, I went to the New England Conservatory to study singing when I got out of college. And every recital we did, they would always say I was the best actress singer. Not that I was the best singer. So I had a little feeling about myself that I wasn't really a singer. Or that I wasn't really a good singer, but I could act the songs. So that worked. I did many musicals also on Broadway. I started out in a musical with Ethel Merman, Happy Hunting. And I did many musicals on Broadway, and then I went to all the Brecht stuff because it was much more interesting music than a lot of flop musicals, which I did on Broadway. And then I just fell into acting, and then I got really successful as an actor without singing. And in this show, it's wonderful because I play this very unhappy old grandmother. And so then in the last scene of the thing, I burst into song and everybody is totally shocked because why is this grandmother bursting into song? It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song, a quartet, the four women in the play. One of them's 10 years old, the other two are in the middle, and then there's me, I'm old. And it's a song about Penelope waiting, you know, for Odysseus to come home from the war, because it's a show about the First World War and the unknown soldier. You know, in the First World War, I think because there were developments of weapons and so on, but a lot of Americans went off to war, and they were never heard from again. So there were hundreds of thousands of people in this country who had lost sons or lovers or brothers or whatever, and they just never heard again what happened to them. It was a terrible, terrible thing. And then this is all a true story that the play musical is based on. Mm. I guess you'd call it a play with music. And then this soldier with amnesia was picked up in Grand Central. He was a vagrant. And the doctor then who treated him said, well, let's take him around and see if anybody who lost somebody, you know, recognizes him, or more to the point that he would recognize somebody around the country that he belonged to. So they did that. It didn't exactly work out. But what was shocking was that there were thousands and thousands of people who came to this to see this guy, and some of them actually believed that he was their relative or lover or whatever. They were so crowded with grief, because I spoke to a psychiatrist and I said, is this possible, what they say in this play, that all these people come and think this person is their close relative, their loved one, and it's not? And he said, it's very possible, because grief does, you know, big things to your emotional structure. Mm. So my character, when her husband dies in the war, she goes to see this unknown soldier, and she thinks that he is her husband.
You know,
it's a good story.
It sounds like it, and it'll be opening very soon.
Yeah, it's in previews now. It's just the official opening night we have to get through, where, you know, everybody comes and takes pot shots at it, right? Maybe they'll say Estelle Parsons is a terrible singer, but I don't think they will.
What is that? What are the reviews like when you're in a play like that, or you're in a musical? Opening night, the critics come and they...
Yeah, they don't come opening night anymore, you know.
Oh, really?
They come the four or five. Like, I think our show will be Frozen probably Wednesday or Thursday, and then they will come. They will come Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, to Saturday, to Sunday. So opening night is really a festival of friends and backers and just a wonderful festive night, saying, look at what we think we have accomplished here with this wonderful material. But the critics have usually all been there by then. They come during that week before.
Do you read the reviews?
Oh, yeah, I do.
I only
did one show where I didn't read reviews because I knew I wasn't too right in it. I played Colette, and it was, I didn't think I ever really got that character. So I thought, this time I better not read the reviews or I won't get myself to work.
What?
And then I read them after the thing was over.
What?
They weren't that bad. But the funniest thing that happened to me once was I was doing Major Barber, and at the opening night party, this was out in Cincinnati at the Playhouse in the Park, and the opening night party, this man, one of the sponsors of the theater, came up to me and said, that was a wonderful performance. It certainly wasn't Major Barber, but it was a wonderful performance. I love that, but you know, a lot of actors are doing that. These days, if you stand up and say lines intelligently, everybody thinks you're a good actor. And of course, you may not be. You may be only playing yourself, you know. You may not be playing what the play requires at all. But just because you're standing up and saying things as if you know what you're talking about, people think you're a wonderful actor. It's a very bad time to be in theater right now.
Well, that's interesting. Now, is that what makes it a bad time to be in theater?
Because all of the best people go into film and TV now. That's what's sexy, to be in film. I'm talking about directors and people who put things together, you know, producers, directors, and that sort of thing. There was a whole period there when television started. Well, in the first place, theater used to be it, right? With big stars and wonderful stuff. And then film came along. And then gradually all the best people, directors and writers, because they're the important people, went into film. And then TV came along. And that really decimated the New York scene, because that started out in California. It's very big in New York now, as big as it is in California. But when it started, it was in California, so all the best directors and playwrights went to TV, and that's where they've all remained now, where the money is. People have to earn a living, you know. You can't really... I make, I think, $700 a week, which is, you know, not a really living wage for a man or a woman with a family.
Does, at this point in your career, when you take a part, when they offer the money, does the money matter or does the part matter?
Oh, money's never mattered to me at all. I don't. Only the part matters to me. Money never matters. Wherever the best roles are. And it has to be a role as a human being. I'm not interested in doing parts that are contrivances for the benefit of the play. You know, I don't like that. I have to see a kernel of a human being that I can create. That sounds crazy, because this is a human being created in the mind of a playwright or, you know, film writer or TV writer. But if I can't see a person there, I can't really play it. You know, meaning I don't play myself. You know, if I'm just pretending to be somebody, that doesn't work for me. I have to actually be that somebody. When I walk out on that stage, I'm actually that person. That's how I feel. That's my mind construct.
Well, see, that's an interesting point when I talk to actors or actresses. I think that's fascinating because... How much of Estelle Parsons is in a part that you play? If nothing else, they kind of look like you, in a way.
Of course they do. It ends up that it's all of you and all of the character. That's what great acting is all about, where it's all of you and all of the character. And what the audience sees is all of the character created by all of you, and that makes acting an art form, which is what I've been interested in all my life. I mean, it's like they go and see a painting, and they see, like, you know a Rothko painting is a Rothko painting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know a character I make is a character that Estelle Parsons made, right? I think it's the same sort of thing. But great acting is the whole person. I mean, Stanislavski and Lee Strasberg and Boleslavsky and Vakhtangov, everybody would believe that. Great acting is the person and the artist, the character come together. The person who is the acting artist and the character written by a playwright, say Chekhov, when they come together. And that's what the audience sees, and that's what the audience responds to. It's a very deep trust, truth, reality kind of situation that creates great theater. And you know, they do research in Sweden, which they did research on audiences, and they found that when an audience was having a group experience, having a theatrical experience, their hearts beat in the same rhythm, the people in the audience.
Hmm.
If they're having a real theatrical experience, everybody in that group's heart will be beating the same way, and I assume my heart is beating the same way, too. So we're all, like, in the rhythm of life because, you know, and that has to do with music. Music is the art form to which all other arts aspire. And it all has to do, I think, with a truth that has something to do with something which is non-existent, and that is usually called our soul.
Hmm. That's very interesting. Now, when you are creating a character for the stage or the screen or television, are there different processes that go into that?
No, I don't think so. I think the difference is in the amount of time you have to do it. They're all written differently. I mean, you read a film script and you know exactly what it is, and when you read it, you respond to it. When you read a really good play script, you usually put it down and say, wow, I don't know what that is, but I just know I've got to do it. So it's a completely different thing. And television is yet again a third kind of thing. I mean, they've started really seriously to do television writing in, conservatories for writers now because television is the big thing now, of course. So that's yet another kind of writing that's very accessible.
Mm.
So that you can learn it and do it and put on the right costume and it works. Those mechanical media, I call them, you know, really have their own rules, so to say. The meaning of things is totally different. You know how I learned that? I was watching... I did a movie with Peter Fonda called Two People. We were in Morocco for months and months and months because the sun was supposed to shine there 365 days a year, but they didn't say, like, in which part of Morocco that sun might be shining. So we were there for a very, very long time waiting for the sun to come out. But when I saw the tests, the screen tests for costumes for that, I mean, when Peter Fonda came, you know, you see me and Lindsay Wagner and Peter, and I forget, Fudge was in it. I forget some of the other people. But anyway, when Peter Fonda came on that screen, he just had an effect that nobody else did, you see, because of his bone structure. So when you're working in film, you know, if you have a certain bone structure, 90% of your work is done.
Hmm.
It's very strange.
That is interesting. Now, Estelle, you were there at the start of the Today Show. The Today Show's still going on.
I was one of eight people who put the Today Show together in 1949.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was no morning television. Nobody thought it would work, which I think is how I got the job. The producer was a guy who ended up being a vice president of NBC. He was actually responsible for Today and Tonight, which are still on the air, of course. And I think I got the job because people who were already in nighttime television, like Sid Caesar's show and stuff like that, didn't want to take a risk on morning television because nobody thought that it would last. And, of course, look what has happened. So there were eight of us, I think. Two people from the news department, and then I was doing features, book features, fashion features, and then eventually I graduated into news features from that, and there were two other women who did the kind of work I was doing, and that was even before they picked Dave Garraway. They looked at all the comedians around it. But, you know, there were two people. People don't even realize that there used to be some people who knew what to do with that medium, and that was Dave Garraway and Arthur Godfrey, were really gifted as television, to run television programs.
Why?
Now it's all, everything's done technically. But they before all the technical stuff got so good, you know, they were two people who just knew how to connect with the people at home on the other side of those huge boxes those men were pushing around on wheels at the time. And, of course, the teleprompter started then on the Today Show. We were the first people to try that out when someone decided you could put the stuff up there instead of having to read it off a piece of paper. It's so funny because when I went back to do the Conners, the last time, they were just starting to see if they wanted to use teleprompters, too, because, you know, you do a show a week, and if it's a very, very heavy show, you know, word-wise for you, it might be good to have a teleprompter. I know some people have cards, big cards they hold up if people can't remember lines, stuff like that. But they were just trying out teleprompters, and I thought, wow, I was there when the first teleprompters appeared in a TV studio back in 1950 in New York.
What made
it? It was a great time. It really was. I like to be in on pioneering things like that. And Dave Garraway and I used to do the commercials. And, you know, you'd look at the clock and you'd do a commercial for a minute. You'd just make it up yourself. You knew what you were going to do. And you'd just make it up yourself and talk for the minute. You'd watch the clock go around and you could talk for 30 seconds. Sometimes you could talk for a minute. It was a skill that pretty soon you didn't need anymore because then the companies came in with their own script writers, copywriters, or whatever they call them, and then you had to learn those things, and then you had to read them off the teleprompter. But originally, we just knew what we had to say and just said it, made it up any way we wanted to for the minute, which you can see makes for a little more spontaneous and interesting relationship with the audience if you're talking directly to them about stuff you know something about because you've just learned how to make this pudding, you know, where you have to beat it up for a minute, stuff like that. You know what you were talking about. Now you don't know what you're talking about. You're just reading off a piece of paper.
What made Dave Garraway so great? He was great in Chicago. He met an unfortunate, untimely ending. But what made him so great?
I think his sense of timing, and his sense of speaking directly to the person behind the machine, which is a skill. I guess you could develop that skill, or you have it naturally, I guess, because sometimes I used to replace him in the summer when he went on vacation. But I never could be him. He had a very personal, slow way of doing things. But you never thought it was slow. You just thought you were really being talked to, you know? It was a unique kind of gift that he had.
Estelle, you're still working in television today. The Conners is on ABC television. It's the Roseanne revival, which became The Conners. When you first went back to do the revival, when Roseanne was still with the show, what was it like to go back after all those years?
Oh, it was wonderful. And we all said, hello, hello, hello. And then, you know, like within half a day, we all felt like we'd never been away. We were all away 10 years. And then when we got back together, and a lot of those people are still there. Not all of them, of course, but a lot of them are still there. When you go back now to do the Conners with Rosie gone, that was the hard part, Rosie being gone. But when we went back for the revival of Roseanne, it was just great. We had a wonderful time, all of us. It was unfortunate, everything that happened there.
What is it like now to go do the show with Roseanne not being there?
The writers are very, very, very good, but Rosie had a way of really cutting to the chase with humor, I guess because she'd done so much stand-up. And so the humor is a little different than it used to be when she was there. I loved working with her. I worked with almost all the great comics, Jackie Gleason and all, and I really loved working with them, so it was hard going back without her. It was hard for everybody. But they've made a wonderful show of it, and the writers are really, 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 really good. So,
did you?
It's just a different kind of experience.
Have you spoken to her after the incident?
No. You know, I was, she was more a colleague, I'm proud to say, because she was so great, but then a friend. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
We all worked together, but I lived in New York. They would call up and say, can you come out? And I'd say yes, or I'd say no, I'm in a show. And they'd say, well, when can you come? And we still have that kind of, I still have that kind of arrangement with them. When I'm not working in the theater, you know, I can go out for a week and do something with them. And it was really wonderful.
When all that was going on with Roseanne, what did you make of that?
Well, I'm in New York, so I didn't know anything much about it, you know. I've never been really a part of anything out there because even though half of my whole family or 90% of my family live out there, but I have never spent any time out there, so I wasn't part of any of anything that went on.
Why is New York the place where you like to be?
Because I'm in the theater, and the best audiences are in New York. I try to go where the best audiences are, and they're definitely in New York. I work all over the country touring and everything with shows, but the best audiences are in New York, and that has been changing over the years because television has brought information on so much stuff to people, so... Audiences used to change. They were very intellectual in New England, and then they were very responsive intellectually and emotionally in New York. And then the further west you went, the less they listened, the less good the theater audience was, because I don't know, I guess they had less theater. But you could feel, you know, New York would grasp material that people in the Middle West and further west would not grasp. But that's not true anymore, and I think it's because people now all know the same things, you know, from television. So now the audiences are pretty much the same wherever you go, but theater is not so sexy anymore. They used to care when you came to town, you know. They just really cared that you were there and loved it. And now they don't. They all have regional theaters of their own, and nobody cares about theater anymore except those of us who do it.
Mm. Tell me about doing Bonnie and Clyde.
What can I tell you about that? I wanted to work with Arthur Penn. I'm not interested in those, you know, in films. And I turned down several, and I just work in the theater. And I want, but I was working with Arthur Penn in the theater, and he said, "Would I do this movie?" And I said, "Well, I don't really do movies. I'm going to San Francisco to join a rep company, and it's not what I do." And then the more I read that script, the more I thought, "Wow, this is really a terrific part." And he made it possible for me to have to do the kind of work that I do. I had just been very confused about what I was doing, what acting was all about, and I didn't get along with directors, and the whole commercial system in the theater didn't work for me. And I did some experimental work with him in the theater, and then I realized the kind of powers and strengths and talent that I had, and that I had it, and it was all wonderful. It was like all the notes on the piano were in the right place. So I thought, well, I'll do it because it's Arthur, and the company that I was going to join fell through at the last minute. The money went away, and we couldn't go to San Francisco and have our rep company. So I said, oh, okay, I'll do it. I had two kids to support, too, but I don't think that ever made much difference.
You won the Academy Award for Bonnie and Clyde, 1967. What was it like to win the award?
Well, that, you know, I was just thinking the other day, that affects your whole life, you know. Even now, and it's all those years ago from 67, so very, very long ago, but people still respect you because, you know, if you say you're an actress, people don't know really what that means. It covers a lot of territory, as we know. And but if you've won an Academy Award, that's kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval, and it lasts forever, you know, if you've done that.
Now, do you keep the Academy Award on display?
No, I think it's on the floor somewhere in my bedroom because I used to have it on a shelf with my other awards, but everybody wanted to see it, and then I'd have to go get on the ladder and get it off the shelf. So I keep it on the floor so if people come in and say, "Ooh, where's your Academy Award?" I can just haul it out.
What did it mean to you personally, that award?
Absolutely nothing, because I didn't want a film career. I think it's terribly important if you want to have a film career. But I didn't want to. I was in a show in New York. I didn't even want to go to the ceremony, but Warren Beatty said, "Come on, we're sending you a ticket, come out." And David Merrick, who was a very famous Broadway producer, was producing the Tennessee Williams show I was in. And he said, "I'm putting your standby on, and you are going out there. You're not going to be able to play. Even if you stay here, you'll be sitting at home." So I got myself out there. It was a wonderful little experience, but it didn't have a big professional meaning to me at the time. But over the years, one cannot, you know, I'm happy that I won it, because over the years, that's what people know about you, and it means something to other people, and that's important. Other people are important.
What do you make of the whole award scene in general? Emmys, Academy Awards, Tony Awards. Do you think there should be awards for acting?
I don't think any of us really like that idea, you know, to be held up against each other. I don't think any of us really like it. You know, Marlon Brando was the most vocal about how awful it was, but The first award I won, which was a Theater World Award, which is for newcomers in the theater, the first acting job I did. And I didn't even go to the ceremony because I thought, I just want to go out there and have people be excited by what I do. And if I start getting awards, you know, when I walk out there, they're going to be like, okay, you got an award, show me what you do. And I don't like that. I like it. And I like to... I like to have people discover my work. That maybe is really crazy or probably not too smart, but on the other hand, it's the way I am. Even now, like, if I get entrance applause when I go on the stage, I sort of wish I didn't get it. I like it. I like applause at the end. And entrance applause is okay. I mean, it means people say, oh, here comes Estelle, and we're glad to see her. What's she going to do for us? It's okay. But they're definitely, it definitely was very upsetting to me to not be something to be discovered rather than something that was supposed to be good.
Well, it's kind of an interesting topic because being on The Roseanne Show, with it being a number one series at one point, and being in Bonnie and Clyde, and still being on television today, when a New York audience sees you, they know who you are. What do they most recognize? What do they say to you when they walk up to you?
Oh, they say I'm Roseanne's mother. Or they say, one woman said to me, I saw you in Bonnie, a grandmother said to me, I saw you in Bonnie and Clyde when I was 16 in Greece. And I thought, God, isn't that amazing? Isn't that just amazing? You meet somebody in front of a theater who's a grandmother now, and at 16 she saw you in Bonnie and Clyde in Greece. I think that's an amazing kind of thing, you know. And then I was in a restaurant, and this poor waiter, he almost fell down. He loves the Connors so much and loved Roseanne so much. And he said, I'm shaking, I'm going to have a heart attack. His boss, the maitre d', was not too happy. But the poor kid, he really, really loved Roseanne. So, you know, they say all kinds of things. And then a lot of people say, oh, I know you. And then they don't know me, you know. They say, I know you. You're the friend of my friend on the third floor. And I say, no, I'm not the friend of your friend on the third floor. I'm Estelle Parsons. You probably saw me in Roseanne.
Well, it's interesting. When people approach you, they feel like they know you because of these television series and movies.
Yeah.
What is the biggest misconception that people have because of that, thinking that you're those characters?
I don't think they have any misconceptions, do they?
I don't know. How close are you to those characters?
How close am I?
Yeah, the person.
Well, I am those characters. What do you mean, how close am I?
Personality-wise.
Oh, well, no. I mean, with Bonnie and Clyde, sometimes they come up and say, I hate you. And I know what they were talking about, so just laugh.
What does it take to be a creative person? Because not everybody is creative. Painters, sculptors, musicians, actors. Do you think there's something different about those people?
Well, in the first place, you have to have talent, or you should have talent. Some people fake it, but you have some kind of talent, and then you're going to do it. There isn't much question. If you have a certain kind of talent, whether you realize it or not, I mean, you are going to express yourself. And there's not much to think about there. You're just going to express yourself. You're going to look for an experience, a time and a place to express yourself, and you're going to express yourself. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what other people do, but... I do know, now that I'm 92, I do know that I'm a very, very strong person, that I've done in my life only the things I wanted to do, and I've never lied to myself, which I think is the most important thing.
Well,
I think a sense of truth is the most important thing to get through life as a really strong person. But I think it's like any profession. You've got to be really strong, and you've got to see what's going on around you, and you've got to make the decisions that are going to make your life work for you. You know, sometimes parents say, oh, do this. But if you know that isn't going to work for you, you know, you don't do it. You have to have the ability to do what you know works for you.
What is the secret to that, Estelle? Being 92, still working, still happy, what's the secret?
Well, you just have to be true to yourself. I can see that it's not easy for all people to be true to themselves. Some people think other people know better than they do. And other people don't know better than you do. The person who knows what's best for you is inside you, not somebody else, ever. That's how I feel, but, you know, everybody's probably different.
Estelle, before we part ways here today, when people look back 100 years from now at Bonnie and Clyde or the Roseanne show or a piece you did on stage, how do you hope they remember you?
Well, I just think they'll have a good experience. They don't have to remember me. They just have to have a good experience, be entertained, be communicated with, you know, be maybe educated in certain ways, have compassion for. I think the theater is very good in having people have compassion for other people. But of course, when I'm dead, I won't be in the theater. I'll just be on all those other things. But I'm proud of all those other things I did. When I look back on them, I think, wow, that's pretty good. Because when I'm doing them, I never think they're good enough. You know, that's part of the creative process, that you always, your artistic process, that you always think, that's okay, but there's more, you know. I don't know. I guess there is always more in life. I don't know.
Well, I certainly know we've had a good experience this morning. Estelle, it's always a pleasure.
That's good.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. You're one of the great actresses. We love to watch you, and I hope you come back in the future, and I hope you have a great opening night.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Stay well.
Bye.
Bye-bye. The very unique and entertaining Estelle Parsons, and you can see her on the Conners or on a stage near you in New York. She's always a lot of fun. All right, we're done for the day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Over the dam, so to speak. You know, if they would say, yeah, come on back, you know, let's let cooler heads prevail, absolutely, I would get rid of the lawsuit. You know, this was the lawsuit was just a means by winning the conversation to the university. And